Kuzminski. We are here today with Rosalind Johnson from the Federation of Teachers. And this is going to be an exciting event today because I don't think we've had anyone on our program today, both from Philadelphia and from Teachers Union. Rosalind, I'd like to give us a little bit of background about yourself and about what the Federation of Teachers is for us.
Daria, at this time, I'm now serving as the Director of Educational Issues for the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers. And this is a new position within the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers because this is an exciting time for our organization because the culture of this union is changing. It has been traditionally a labor union that focused pretty much on the bread and butter contractual issues. But entering the 21st century, we realize that we have to learn to balance the needs of our members who are teachers with the interests of the children. And that also means taking more responsibility for the profession of teaching. It is as important, if not more important, than being concerned about salaries and health benefits. So I'm very excited to be able to take on this responsibility, and I do believe it's a step in the right direction, not only for our union, but for the children of Philadelphia. My background, I spent 28 years teaching in the School District of Philadelphia, a job that I absolutely loved. And it's wonderful to be able to be paid for doing something that you enjoy so much. But my background is a little bit unusual because while I taught in the School District of Philadelphia for almost 15 years, I had an opportunity also to work in education at the state level and from a policy level. And it's a very interesting opportunity to be where policy meets practice. In 1987, we had a Secretary of Education. His name was Tom Gilhool, who had a background in law, but a very healthy respect for teachers. He felt they were very important. So he invited 10 teachers across the state to serve as his special assistants and his advisors on education. And that was my first opportunity working with the Secretary. And what he did was he taught me the importance of linking research and practice. One of our first responsibilities was to really examine the research and make recommendations for best programs for the children in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. After that opportunity, I served as an advisor to the State Board of Education. At that time, our General Assembly was asked to develop a code of professional conduct and practices for teachers so that our teachers in Pennsylvania would take more control of their profession. And I served on the Professional Standards and Practices Commission and chaired the commission while the code was being developed. I had opportunities to serve on the State Board of Education and to work really with program approval for teacher education in Pennsylvania. And once I finished my coursework for my doctoral program, I was asked to get involved with the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers because they had taken responsibility for improving instruction in 6 of our schools that were considered low achieving. The Federation felt that they need to take more responsibility for assisting these schools, a friendly approach, not one of that was punitive, that involved sanctions. So I served as the Quest director of those 6 schools, and that was an interesting, very interesting partnership between the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers and the school district. So from those responsibilities, I moved to working more with the Federation, and now I'm their Director of Educational Issues.
Now, what is it? Is there a difference, or what is the difference, and when did the Federation start, and is it just in Philadelphia? It is across the state, and how many teachers are in the Federation, and how are you different from the PSEA?
Let me start with the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers and its emphasis on professionalism. This is not a local movement. Al Shanker, the national president of the AFT, really began to examine issues with teacher professionalism and led to, of course, the national board certification. So this is not unique in Philadelphia. It has been a part of the change of the culture in the AFT for some time now. How do we differ from the PSEA? Well, I think that recently what we're doing is not looking at our differences, but what we have in common. You know, there's a movement across the country to merge these two organizations, and I think that's moving into a positive direction in Pennsylvania. So the AFT and the PSEA are, I think, more alike than different now, and I think both organizations are really focusing as much on improving the profession and being advocates for education and children as they are being a labor organizations.
Al Shanker is a very, very open thinker and an extraordinary person. I've read a lot of his work, and there seems to the basis for the Federation of Teachers, the base of it, seems to be a much more open and willing to change more rapidly than I think perhaps the, and correct me if I'm wrong in this, than my perception of PSEA. Because of his national publicity, Al Shanker, you know, he's been on the out front of looking at testing, looking at all kinds of other things as perhaps not in the best interest of our children. Do you feel that you can merge those ideas with the more traditional PSEA?
I think the AFT was extremely fortunate to have a leader like Al Shanker. And if we are, the AFT seems to be more progressive than the NEA, it's probably because of Al Shanker and our organizational structure that did not have term limits on the presidency. So he was there. Al Shanker worked with the AFT long enough to institutionalize his vision, to mentor those. So I just think that the AFT was very fortunate to have a visionary leader like Al Shanker. I think, yes, the two organizations are different, and I think that is one of the reasons why we could not merge on a national level. There are a lot of issues that we need to work out, but I hope that we can focus on finding that common ground, because I think it's not only a benefit to these two organizations, but a benefit to children and teachers in general if we can work together as advocates and improve the working conditions for teachers. Because, Daria, across the country, there is a national shortage of teachers, particularly in mathematics and science. We cannot separate this shortage issues from the working conditions of teachers and salaries. So those issues are still important. So it's very important that these two organizations really learn to look at each other's strengths and develop a collaborative relationship. And I want to look forward in terms of these two organizations. And as I said, despite any differences that we may have, I think it will benefit both organizations for us to come together and find that common ground.
Would you explain to the people who are listening how Philadelphia School District is set up? It is, from an outsider personally, it is very difficult to comprehend. Now, you have some 200,000 students, I believe. How is the Philadelphia School District set up? It seems to be different than the rest of the schools around the state.
Well, let me give you a little background on the schools within the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. First of all, Philadelphia is the only Class 1 school district in the state of Pennsylvania. It is the sixth largest. Class 1 school district means that it is a very large school district. The next largest district would be Pittsburgh, which is one-fifth the size of Philadelphia. Philadelphia has over 200,000 children, so therefore it's considered a Class 1 or large school district. Therefore, with the national movement, and I can say sometimes now an international movement, to decentralize, mean move education from the control of a central administration, break up the district into smaller districts. Philadelphia's organizational structure is very different from other districts in the state out of necessity. You cannot manage 200,000 children from one large administrative office. You need to move, or the thought was that we needed to move the management structure closer to the communities. However, Philadelphia School District is divided up into 22 what we call clusters or management districts. This design or organizational design was supposed to revolve around the high schools area. So what we have is 22 high schools, and those high schools are linked with middle schools and elementary schools. However, with the mobility issue, and particularly in urban areas, it is very rare that children move from an elementary school into a middle and a high school. So that organizational model, while it seems to be a design that serves the needs of the children, what it does is it seems to concentrate the resources at the management level rather than at the classroom levels. And this is, it is an organizational design that was supposed to make service more efficient, but it seems to have created unnecessary bureaucracy because the 22 districts are still there. Each has a cluster leader, which is a superintendent type of administrative position, but we still have that central control. And Philadelphia's rationale was that we changed the organizational structure and the delivery of education and learning would improve, but in fact, I think it has complicated matters.
So you've discovered what it took us 30 years to find out. It's that the external infrastructure really is not the key issue. It's the internal infrastructure that really needs to change. How do you see, or how does the Federation see, what direction do you think Philadelphia needs to go in order to be able to overcome many of the problems that seem to exist within the district itself?
Philadelphia, like schools across the country, need to recognize that external monitoring and organizational structure doesn't really improve student achievement. In order to really have schools that service children, we have to focus first on the community, the parents, the children, the teachers, and the principal, building principal. Those are the stakeholders that really are close enough to the children in the community to understand and define the standards for those children. Those are the ones that are truly accountable. Every day when that principal and teacher walk in that building, they are accountable to the children and the parents, and the children and the parents should be accountable to the school. Those are the stakeholders that really need to work together to develop a workable plan that will really develop lifelong learning and not just test-taking skills, but really prepare students to participate in the democratic society.
You have been listening to Children Come First. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski. We're here today with Dr. Rosalind Johnson from the Federation of Teachers in Pennsylvania. And if you'd like to reach us, you can call us at 877-PRO-KIDS. That's 877-PROKIDS. If you'd like to reach Dr. Johnson, you may call her at 215-561-2722. That's 215-561-2722, or you can email her at rosj702@aol.com. That's rosj702@aol.com. Now let's get back to this, the Philadelphia School District. There is a great deal of conversation with legislators about the money that is coming into the Philadelphia School District, and it doesn't show in their estimation, the assessment doesn't show that there's improvement, and on we go. Well, when I go into the Philadelphia area, There is such a diversity of the different areas in terms of the diversity of the population, the diversity of the schools, the diversity of the community. It's comparing seeds and peanuts and oranges, in my estimation. There's really not a comparison between the different, and to lump them all together as one, to me, does not seem fair. Do you think is my observation correct, or am I off here?
No, Daria, I don't think you're off. What Pennsylvania is doing, and even the city of Philadelphia, is using a standardized testing model to determine student achievement. But what is quite interesting is that there are no longitudinal study or longitudinal data to show where a child, what their instructional level is once they enter the system. We do not measure student achievement over time. We're looking at cross-sectional data where we may be looking at maybe a cohort, a group of third graders. What we need to do is focus on the individual child. We need to look at each child and find out where that child is from one point in time, maybe the beginning of the school year, where that child is at the end of the school year, measure that growth. If the child is not achieving, we need to really carefully take a careful look at that child and find out where the intervention needs to occur. Perhaps it might be instruction at the school level. It may be low expectation or not enough resources, but whatever it is, we need to stop lumping children together, and we need to take personal responsibility for monitoring the achievement levels of every child as they move through the system. This is not unreasonable if we understand that it is the responsibility of schools and teachers and parents to monitor the growth. This is not a responsibility that should come from a top-down, quick-fix type of approach for measuring student achievement. While the collective data is not positive, Daria, what is positive is that we have a tremendous amount of information about the children in the School District of Philadelphia. We know we need to look at health issues. We know we need to look at low birth weights and the educational levels of the parents, because these are also risk factors that our children face. I think there's an understanding that our children need a much smaller adult child ratio, because unusual circumstances calls for unusual solutions. So if our children have extraordinary needs, and they do come to us with a lot of risk factors, we do need to reduce the ratio so that adults can pay a lot of attention to what's happening with children, so that we can not only look at schooling, but we can link with social service agencies and ask the state for those additional resources, because our children are indeed our most precious resource. Why should we have a surplus at the state level and have buildings that perhaps have old pipes with lead in them, when we can't offer summer school opportunities, when we can't offer early learning opportunities for all of our children, when we can't send books into homes. So yes, it's easy to criticize, but it's more important to really do a thorough analysis. After you find out there's a problem, then you get into a problem-solving mode. You take a look at the reasons why our children are not achieving. Take a look at each of those children, monitor their instruction. So yes, the criticism is there, but I don't think that they've done the hard on the ground work that it takes to really understand how children learn and what we need to do to improve instruction in Philadelphia.
Well, you are really making a point that I would like to, for all the legislators who are listening and all the policymakers who are listening to this, what they don't understand is that we're talking about the difference here between a school system that has 200,000 students comparing them to school districts that only have 2,000 or 3,000 students. And it is and the difference between Center City and the resources in Center City and the communities in Center City and the societal ramifications here and the difference in the rural areas. So, because Pennsylvania is basically a rural state where many of the legislators come from. And what you alluded to a little bit earlier and that we really need to look at is the emotional state of children. Most people don't understand, and we know this from our brain research, when a child has emotional issues at the home level, the brain goes into a flight-fright modality. It shuts down. That's not educators' fault. The ability for a child to learn stops when the emotional issues are there in the home. Now, we learned this from Columbine, because at Columbine, after Columbine, the level of student achievement dropped dramatically. And that is because we know as psychologists, children cannot learn if they're emotionally upset. It takes, from a tragedy like Columbine, at least a year to 18 months for the brain to go back to a normal mode where it's not producing endorphins. How can we possibly expect educators to educate children who are dealing with the kinds of emotional issues that you talked about in terms of their homes? You know, whether it's the drug problems or the, you know, whatever it is that's going on in their community. It's a whole community effort, as you were saying.
How can we hold educators and schools responsible when there are so many societal issues? I think what an educator has to be held responsible for is really having the best knowledge base possible and the best practices possible. If we in fact know that our children are coming to school with many social and emotional problems, then we need to learn to work with organizations and provide those kinds of support, if not within the school, then from outside of the school. We are very fortunate in Philadelphia to have the Mid-Atlantic Regional Laboratory for Student Success located right in Philadelphia within Temple University. We're fortunate because there's such wonderful research that comes out of the lab that lab can provide the kind of information to not only to teachers, to parents, to administrators about the emotional needs of children. So, Daria, we have all the information we need in terms of knowing what we need to do for children. Our responsibility at the school level is to be able to tap into those resources and to serve as advocates for those children, not to fail to recognize that those children have problems and address it would be irresponsible on our part, and that's where we can be held accountable.
We know now that we have a 150-year-old, so give or take a few years, infrastructure in education that was based on an industrial model to create good soldiers and factory workers. We think and we look at children as products we still are in that mental mindset of looking at children as products. Even our terminology that we use, you know, constantly refers back to children as a product. We test them, we have assessments. It's always a product-oriented mentality. And I think with the new thrust in looking at it as a learning process, the process is much more of looking at a child as a whole human being rather than as a product that's manufactured and spit out of our educational system. How can we adapt Philadelphia schools to the best interest of the students and the learning process? What kinds of things can we do to help create that for students?
You're right about our schools are large. They look like factories. The bell schedules, even the teachers signing in, signing out, the children are in line, they're orderly. It does look a lot like the assembly line model. Yes, our physical plants are old, but can we, within those physical plants, design systems that really work for our children? I think we can do it by breaking those schools up to smaller units and having teachers involved with children for much longer periods of time. We have what's called small learning communities in Philadelphia. This is an attempt to break larger buildings up into smaller units that service the children. However, you must, when you do this, you have to consider equity. Equity in terms of human resources and material resources. And right now, when we divide buildings up, sometimes, for example, one of our middle schools has 42 brand new first and second year teachers. So when you divide this school up into small learning communities, you still have a lot of inexperienced staff. So what we have to do is once we decide we need to break the school down in smaller, more manageable, child-centered types of organizations, we have to make sure that within those communities that the children have equal access to competent teachers and resources. So this is, no, it doesn't solve all of our problems, but we have to work within the fiscal realities of the School District of Philadelphia. And if we can take some of these larger units and break them down into smaller units and also partner with other higher education institutions, nonprofit organizations, there's learning takes place not only within the school but outside of the school. So forming partnerships and really thinking of schools not in terms of large structures but children and working with them over longer periods of time and equalizing resources, we might be able to service our children a little bit better.
In business, when we have managerial problems, we downsize. In education, when we have managerial problems, we upsize. And I think we need to look at the business aspect, and I think you're right about downsizing because the successes are across the board, across the nation, come from not just smaller classrooms, but smaller schools. It's much more manageable when the principal knows the name of every student, not because they're a behavior problem, but because they know the children because they see them every day and they're in the community and they're working in the community. So I think you're absolutely right. You are listening to Children Come First. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski. We're here with Dr. Rosalind Johnson from the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers. If you'd like any information from Dr. Johnson, you may call her at 215-561-2722. That's 215-561-2722. You may email her at rosj702@aol.com. That's rosj702@aol.com. Or you may reach us anytime here at Children Come First at toll-free 877-PRO-KIDS. That's 877-PROKIDS. And we will be back in our second half hour, and we'll be talking more about the Philadelphia School District as well as other issues regarding children and the Philadelphia area as well as the rest of the state. Please join us.
B.
reached Washington about the deterioration of schools, particularly in urban areas and high poverty areas. I think there's now a national need to recognize we must invest more resources into our physical plants. And when we do, I hope they are much smaller, because as you were saying before, one of the, when we look at high achieving schools, regardless of whether they're in the public or private sector, one thing that they all have in common is that they are small schools. So I think the next time we work on infrastructure or design, hopefully business community will talk to educators about the design of these buildings, because I don't think any teacher would have recommended building a school like Columbine. Size is probably a large part of the problem. So this is an extraordinary opportunity. I think, yes, the state government and federal government needs to get involved in assisting local governments, because we just don't have the funds to do this at the local level. And as I said, as long as the state has a surplus, we have a moral obligation to invest in children.
I think probably those that are listening to us would, and I'm not agreeing or disagreeing, but I know what I've heard as I travel across the state, and that is that we expend a great deal of money in education, and it seems to go at the top, and it doesn't filter down to the students. It seems that we have a lot of administrative salaries, and, you know, the pyramid has turned upside down, where we have all these administrators, and, you know, now you've got 22 superintendent salaries, and I'm sure they have assistant superintendents, and they've got curriculum specialists, and we've got specialists of every kind, and every school has a therapist, and have we gone overboard with, you know, being top heavy?
Yes, I think education at the federal, state, and local level is just entirely too bureaucratic. And when you invest resources in management and organizational structure, clearly those are resources that are not reaching the schools. And as I said, if we learn to treat teachers as professionals and administrators as professionals, I think those individuals within the school are as capable of managing that school as large, complicated bureaucracies. So I think you're right on target. Yes, 22 management districts is absolutely appalling. I think there is a much simpler way to do that. And as I said, I think the most important investment is really to invest in teacher quality and professionalism. You empower teachers to really be able to not only handle resources at the school level, but to design curriculum. And there is no need for large, complicated bureaucracies. Teacher quality really does make the difference.
Well, we know from our experience in our schools that we can operate on funds that are far, far less than most traditional school districts, because our teachers and our principals all design the curriculum. We do not purchase curriculum textbooks like the majority of the other schools do, and we find that our students are also participate in helping design curriculum as well. And when that happens, we have less problems, we have less bureaucracy, we don't have to hire full-time therapists, because we have the kinds of environments where everyone participates and everyone has a part. And, you know, everyone feels better when they are a player and they know they're a player. When you have school boards and we have superintendents and everyone from on high making decisions to filter down all the way through, by the time it gets down to the level of the student, it's turns to water. I mean, it's virtually so fluid that no one has any responsibility whatsoever. And I believe you're right. We need to take the responsibility of education back to the teachers, back to the students, and the principal in the building, who is responsible directly to the community and to the parents, and not the hierarchy of the government, and not the hierarchy of, and we really need to reverse that process. I absolutely believe you're right. And something you alluded to earlier, I'd like you to talk about, because it seems to me that, you know, I just had a conversation over at City Hall here in Philadelphia, and by the way, we're broadcasting this from Philadelphia. It doesn't seem like the right hand knows what the left hand is doing, even at the government level. I wonder if the mayor knows. Do the city council and the mayor operate together, much less the school board operating together with the city council? It seems like there's right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing. Do I have an accurate assumption on that?
I believe you do, Daria. There has been a recent attempt with the election of Mayor Street to have the mayor more accountable, the school board more accountable to the mayor and city council. Because we have it's a peculiar type of institution in Philadelphia where the school board really doesn't have any power to raise funds for the school district. Across the state, it is the school board that really determines the level of funding, that designs the strategic plan, and then is able to raise those resources. But in Philadelphia, actually the taxing power is with the city council and mayor. However, the responsibility for education is with the school board. So they've tried to change this model so that there is more accountability, much more of a collaborative relationship, and the terms of the school board are coterminous with the mayor. So I don't know whether or not this is going to improve education at this time or not. It's an interesting change, is an attempt to bring more accountability and alignment between city council and the mayor, and the jury is still out on this.
Let's get back to the demographics of Philadelphia. I know you said there's 200,000 students, but can you break down a little bit more for our listening audience on the type of students that you have? What are the nationality backgrounds? I think it might be much more diverse than it is from the rest of the state.
I can't give you exact statistics now. But we do have a very large Latino population in Philadelphia. We have children from all over the world. I do believe there are more than 100 languages that the children speak in Philadelphia. So it is a very, very diverse student population. We are having problems. We're definitely having staffing problems, particularly for our ESOL children, English as a second language. It is a challenge. The diversity is definitely a challenge. We're having extraordinary problems recruiting in Philadelphia. Daria, between January 1999 and December 1999, the state had to issue Philadelphia 5,236 emergency certificates to teach in Philadelphia. Daria, Pennsylvania is a state with 90 teacher preparation institutions. We produce a surplus of teachers, but there are 17,000 teachers approximately in Philadelphia. But 5,000 emergency certificates. This means 5,000 people walking into classrooms to teach our very diverse population. Remember the language problems that we have. Philadelphia faces a special challenges, not only a challenge of poverty, but a challenge of location. And what we need to do is prepare a teaching population that's going to be able to meet the needs of Philadelphia's diverse student population. We are not able to do this at this time. There's no reason why we shouldn't be able to do it, because it is not a supply issue. Philadelphia, it is an undesirable, it seems to be an undesirable work location, and we need everybody at the state level, at the local level, to recognize that our children, our diverse population, our children deserve teachers who are going to be able to meet those needs. It's a matter of those who care about educating children to sit down and work out these problems. So while Philadelphia is criticized at the state level, I think very few people in the General Assembly recognize that over a third of our teachers now in Philadelphia have no teaching certificates and have not been prepared. This is an extraordinary job for veteran, experienced master teachers. So, yes, our population is very diverse. We are facing a challenge of teacher quality, but we are trying to develop partnerships through thinking differently about certification, looking at our Puerto Rico and making it very easy to move a certificate from maybe Puerto Rico into Philadelphia without all of the bureaucracy at the state level. We need to partner with our teacher preparation institutions and talk to them about our needs. Have teachers visit Philadelphia because this is a wonderful city. Like you said, it's very diverse, teaching in the Northeast and West Philadelphia, University City. I think once people get into Philadelphia schools, they really would be surprised that there's some wonderful things going on here.
I know it's a little, Mayor Street has already started a project with removing all the cars that are abandoned around the city. And I must say, and I've lived here, so I know the area of it quite well. And sometimes, not for myself, however, for others, the idea of driving around and seeing the gates on the locks on the door storefronts, and you know, all of the wrought iron on people's windows, and you know, the everything that's used to keep vandals away, sometimes this can be very intimidating to people, and I completely can understand that. So I think there is a fear that a lot of people have with major cities, and especially Philadelphia, with the crime and of the past. Perhaps maybe it's not a perception, and yet when I drive down Broad Street today and I look at how colorful Temple has made Broad Street with their red banners and brand new buildings, and things have changed here, and I don't think people who have come from the outside or who listen to people who talk about Philadelphia understand that things have really changed and evolved here. Now, is it safe here? Are you able to walk down the streets here? And I'm saying that after walking down the street at 2 o'clock in the morning this morning. But, you know, is it a safe place here?
I think that safety is a concern everywhere, not only in our cities, but our suburban areas. And it's not just limited to our country. So the perception about cities being violent, I think, no matter where you live, there are always safety issues. I've taught in Philadelphia for 30 years, and I've never really felt any kind of fear about working in the communities. I think once you get into our communities, you find out that people are pretty much people. I think there used to be an organization called the Pennsylvania Academy for the Profession of Teaching, and it had a wonderful program where it was there was a partnership between rural state universities and city schools. And what it did, it brought pre-service teachers into Philadelphia to work in those schools and to do their student teaching. And it was a wonderful surprise for some of these people who had never been in Philadelphia. Some of them absolutely loved our children. They stayed to teach. We have wonderful institutions in Philadelphia, our museums, we have more higher education institutions than any city in the country. We are surrounded by wonderful universities. And what we need to learn to do is look at our strengths,
not our weaknesses. And I think, yes, I'm not being naive about the safety issue. So we do need to be concerned about that. But our teachers don't walk into our communities in fear of the children and the communities. Yes, you can walk around Philadelphia. This is a walkable community. And I think people are beginning to discover that communities like Philadelphia and small suburban communities, walking communities, improve the quality of life. We're not spending hours driving in our car, so we do have some advantages here in Philadelphia.
You are listening to Children Come First. This is Dr. Daria Brzezinski. We're here today with Rosalind Johnson from the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers. If you'd like more information from Rosalind Johnson, you may call her at 215-561-2722. That's 215-561-2722. Or you can email her at rosj702@aol.com. That's rosj702@aol.com. Or you can call us at any time toll free at 877-PRO-KIDS. That's 877-PROKIDS. And we're talking mainly about Philadelphia here, but I kind of want to get in people's minds here that we compare and contrast schools around the state all the time, and it is really an unfair comparison because you cannot compare the rural schools with the city school, with the Philadelphia schools. They are just a totally different entity by virtue of the kind of community that this is. It's a dense community with many people in a very small place, and it is a diverse community when you think of the fact that the children speak 100 different languages. There are 100 different languages here. And when you think about going into a classroom where you might have 20 children in a class who speak 20 different languages, you're talking about another world here as far as a classroom teacher goes. So the kind of diverse issues that exist here are very unique from the rest of the state. Maybe they exist in Pittsburgh, I'm not quite sure, but I know they don't exist in Harrisburg, but it does here because you have the pool here of the two the major institutions, the educational institutions and the medical institutions. So you have Temple and the University of Pennsylvania and Hahnemann, and they're all here, and they're drawing people from around the world to come to school here. And so different things need to be addressed with regard to education. In order to be able to draw industry to come here, the schools have to be, economics and industry are both linked. What do you feel are the greatest, and you know, after, I'm sorry to diverge here, but the 5,200 emergency certificates just is mind-boggling to me, absolutely mind-boggling, that these are people who, you know, we have to get from somewhere in order to be able to come in the classroom. And I don't think people really understand the significance of that in terms of how can you possibly bring people in who are, have not been trained, who are going to be asked to assess a class on demonstrating things that they don't know anything about. I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable that we would even compare them to a state that, or excuse me, a community that has teachers that have are certified and have gone through the process and who understand all of that.
Daria, I think it's very important that we get the message out to the public how important it is to have a quality teaching force. Yes, 5,236 emergency unlicensed teachers in one location is absolutely mind-boggling. It's interesting that even barbers, beauticians, and people who work with animals have to be certified, but our children don't need a certified teacher. For those who don't understand how important this is, let me give you a sports analogy. What do you think would happen to professional teams if they had no first round draft picks? What do you think? What would the quality of those teams be like? Don't our children deserve as much? And I think there's frequently a misunderstanding that anyone can teach. Teaching is a very complex activity. Literacy, T teaching children to read is rocket science. We need the best in the profession. We need highly skilled individuals, and there is no substitute. I hate to say it, but if you don't, that's an expression, garbage in, garbage out. If you don't put in, if you don't invest in children, if you don't give them the resources that they need, how can you expect high student achievement? And I think what is most appalling, Daria, is that while, you know, we talked about maybe a Philadelphia teacher having to teach 20 children, actually, Daria, the ratio is one teacher for every 35 children in the upper grades, one teacher with 33 children in the lower grades. The average class size, and this is usually not an issue in Pennsylvania because the average class size in Pennsylvania, it's about 19 children. And so we're talking about children that have extraordinary needs being taught by maybe one-third of the teachers in Philadelphia uncertified, with children that are experiencing the challenge of location and poverty. So our best and our brightest really need to be here in the city of Philadelphia, and we need to make sure that quality teachers are our first priority.
And I think what that means is that, and this is a personal comment as well, we do not really, we say the children come first in this country, but we really don't prove it. We are willing to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars for computer technicians, for a little baseball that goes over the field. We, because it's a 70th home run, we pay $3 million for. We're willing to pay people who bounce a little ball up and down the street millions of dollars, but we're not willing to pay to have a high quality profession for the greatest resource we have, which is our children. And it's the truth. When we compare and contrast careers in this country, the greatest, we know that the first 6 years of a child's life is the most important. And yet in all of our daycares, we pay minimum wage. So what kind of people are we attracting at the most critical time in a child's life? And when we were talking about certificates earlier to be able to be trained, I was thinking of the fact, licensing, I was thinking of the fact that, you know, we need to fish, you need a license, to do all kinds of things, you need a license. But the two most critical areas are teaching and parenting. And we don't even have a license for parenting. So we really need to rethink our priorities in this country. It is education and it is parenting that we really need to look at. We do a lot of talking about it, but we really don't do a lot in terms of action. And because of that, we are constantly doing quick fixes all the time. And these knee-jerk responses in not thinking about things, and I'm thinking in terms of right now what's happening in Philadelphia, and they're signing a contract with some Texas group who has only had a school in existence for 2 years. They have no track record whatsoever, but they say they're coming in to cure the ills, and here we have another Band-Aid again. So I'd like you you used a wonderful analogy, and you talked about the difference between a political timeline and an educational timeline. Will you talk a little bit about that?
I definitely want to talk about the political timeline and the educational timeline. Frequently, educational change is just mandated, Daria. An example of this is our standards movement. We took the leap from developing state standards and particularly local standards in Philadelphia, and we moved right to the assessment of children. Change takes time, an educational timeline. The implementation strategy should have been a lot different. On an educational timeline, we would have involved standards, we'd have taken time to take a critical look at our curricula. We would take a look at our human resources and our teachers and make sure that we had people who could develop curricula and instructional materials that were aligned to those standards. But frequently,
politicians have to be reelected every so many years, so they don't want to wait around for educational change, but it does take time. We need to take a very critical look now at early childhood education, and when I'm saying time, I'm going to quote some statistics from Marilyn Jaggard Adams. I want to talk about our urban children. She did a study and she found out that mainstream children, middle-class children, upper-middle-class children, are exposed to about 1,500 to 1,800 hours of print before they enter school. Our urban children are exposed to about 40 hours of print. We cannot turn around that kind of deficit overnight because state standards are developed and now the governor is developing tests that are aligned to these standards, and Philadelphia is going to be held to the same standards as the rest of the state. We need time, really, to develop our human resources. We need time to work with young children. We need time to refocus on early childhood education, and as you said before, to really make sure that those children have people who understand issues like early literacy and are able to meet those children's needs. We cannot do that on a political timeline. We must start to function as educators, take a critical look at what we need, reflect, and develop those resources.
Students are, I did a demographic survey of Pennsylvania, and I found that students today, compared and contrast students today from 1950, and our students today are starting farther back from the mark than they did than students in 1950s, whether it's because they were from drug addict parents or because of poverty or other kinds of things. In our wealthy society today, we have a vast majority of our students still farther back from the mark than they were. And we have more students who are dropping out of school than we are who are being born. Rosalind, I want to thank you for joining us today. We've been with Rosalind Johnson from the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers. If you'd like to call her, you can speak with her at 215-561-2722. That's 215-561-2722. Or you can email her at rosj702@aol.com. That's rosj702@aol.com. Or you can speak with me toll free at 877-PRO-KIDS. That's 877-PROKIDS. Or you can email me at prokids@rlc.net. That's prokids, PROKIDS, at rlc.net. Thank you for joining us this week, and we appreciate your coming to visit with us, and we look forward to talking with you and listening again for next week for what we'll be doing with children. Thank you, and have a good week.